The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. The 22nd of November marks 61 years since C.S. Lewis's death. In the lead up to that date, we are going to be hearing an episode from the Unbelievable podcast, which we recorded this time last year to commemorate the 60th anniversary of Lewis's death. What you are about to hear is the second part of a discussion that I had with atheist Dan Barker and Christian Dr. Carolyn Weber. Carolyn, just before the break, we were talking a bit about your story, and you, like Lewis, were somewhat reluctant to become a Christian, weren't you? I mean, obviously in Surprise by Joy, Lewis talks about being the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. Is that sort of how you felt when you became a Christian?
Absolutely. I actually felt that way kicking and screaming prior to the actual sort of handing my life over. What I love about Lewis's description is he says the after effect of looking back at that and realizing that a God that would still accept someone on those terms, right? Still the pride in that sort of realization. But I think ultimately for me, it was really the city of God, the city of man bumping up against each other. And in that, there was something more I wanted, and wanted in the double-edged sword sense of both lacking and wanting. And needing, desiring. And so I didn't read Lewis. I didn't know about Surprise by Joy to the same extent at all until later. So I eventually read more of his works later, but I really resonated with the fact that here I am an academic, here I am from really a background of predominantly unbelievers or people who also think of themselves perhaps culturally as Christian, but because they are good or they're nice. And this was going to be, again, just very inconvenient. And so I think that's more of where my sort of kicking and screaming came from, but there was also an element of help me in my unbelief. And even that was in the Bible. I mean, what I was amazed by is there's something for everyone in the Bible, every single facet of ourselves, as well as different people. So within and without, and that was one of the lowliest of prayers. And I still got to this point, much like Sheldon Vanock, and I had read A Severe Mercy and had been struck by that. That was actually my first introduction to Lewis, and Out of the Narnia Chronicles, older, and where he talked about not being able, eventually for him, being able to reject who Jesus was. It was more of a falling back than a leaping forward. And I think that's really, in a sense, the place that I was at. And I wouldn't have described it as very comfortable.
And I guess the other sort of clear mirroring of some of Lewis's story was that sort of the search for joy, which is what he calls it. And, you know, you say in Surprise by Oxford, your book, joy is the Christian secret weapon. No one else has it in such abundance. And I guess in many ways that kind of mimics a lot of what Lewis says in his works. So in The Great Divorce, he says, here is joy that cannot be shaken. In Surprise by Joy, he says, I sometimes wonder whether all pleasures are not substitutes for joy. So you kind of see this reoccurring theme of searching for joy. But was that something that was true in your story as well, Carolyn?
Well, I think it was the longing, and that I did see a joy in Christians, and it was different than happiness, right? Which is circumstantial, and it was different than pleasure, which, you know, is weird or gross. So there is a sense in which or physical, you know, it was when he talked about all joy reminds, there was this way in which, because he borrowed that title from Wordsworth. And I was, you know, a romanticist at the time. That was my area of study. And Surprised by Joy is a poem by Wordsworth in which actually he experiences joy in the face of great grief, in the face of loss. He's experienced something beautiful for a moment or deeply that creates this longing in himself. And he turns to share it with somebody and realizes that that tomb is empty and it will always be empty. And I think for Lewis to evoke that title is really interesting, because it not only that sense of something that we have lost and yet we are longing for, pointing us to something else, all those desires pointing to a greater desire. But also that even something like grief or loss, pain, suffering, an empty tomb would be a source for something in which we are actually both painfully and joyfully feeling. And that there was something longing we all long for, that I felt to be really common to the human condition, what it meant to be human, and that I felt to myself as well.
Dan, just before we delve specifically into some of Lewis's thoughts and ideas, is there anything that you sort of initially would want to respond to or thoughts you have about Carolyn's story?
Well, she mentioned early on at Oxford that she met some Christians who were living out their faith. And I think I understand what she's saying, because I would have said it the same way. I guess she means things like kindness and compassion and charity and goodness, those kinds of things, very positive things. And I think many, or maybe most Christians, are like that. But I don't think that is quantitatively or even qualitatively different or better from the values and the joy and the experiences that non-believers have. And I know that from personal experience. If joy is your measure, then what's life all about? Is life just being about joy? In my case, joy was not the measure. I mean, joy is great. We all want to be joyful. We all want to have that. In fact, I just wrote a song for the Godless Gospel group called Joy to the World. There is no God, no heaven or hell. And it's true joy. It's real joy. And if you listen to that concert, you'll feel it. I mean, the music, it just makes you. So I'm not denying that Christians like Carolyn feel that joy, and it's wonderful. And I used to feel it and preach it too. But it's not different. It's not better. It's not more lofty. It's not more special than the joy and the compassion and the feelings that we non-believers or Hindus or Muslims or Native American spiritualists all feel. If you look at most of the religions, they all talk about love and joy and peace, right? Like, wow, that's so special. But they all say it. Like, they're offering the world something really special. Our religion talks about peace and love and joy. Well, great. We all love that. But I don't think it makes any difference. I don't think the joy that Carolyn is experiencing, as real as it is, and I'm not knocking it because it's meaningful to you, it's not better. It's not more powerful. It's not more meaningful. It's not more sublime than the joy that comes from being in touch with reason. And for me, joy is not the measure. Truth is the measure. Whether it's true or not is the main question. And it seems fascinating to me, and this is I've been thinking about this for years, that two smart people like me and Carolyn, and you too, Ruth, you're probably the smartest of the three, but
probably
we can both pick up the same Bible and read it with an open, honest, searching heart. Really, we can do that. What does it say? What does it mean to me? And if we're not allowed to do that, then what good is the book, right? I mean, it's supposed to be this word of God to a human race. And so I should be able to pick it up and read it. And yet, look at the different conclusions we come to when we read that book and when we see, for example, the misogyny. And, you know, there's a little bit of joy in the Bible. There's not much joy in the Bible. Most of it is commands and threats. If you read the Old Testament, it's threats and curses. You know, the covenant that God made with his chosen people has, what, maybe 10 verses of here's the blessings that I'm going to give you. But if you don't follow my orders, there's like three times as many curses and pestilences and plagues visited upon your children and your children to the next generation. It's a very brutal, bombastic, jealous, dictatorial type of a structure. When I read it, that's what I see. And it's amazing that Carolyn would read it and not see that. And so what does that tell us? That's telling us something about our disposition, isn't it? It's telling us about what we are bringing to it as we read it. And I've debated a number of Christians, good people, who read the Bible and they don't actually see the brutality, because in their minds it's not there. It's love and it's joy and it's the peace that passes understanding that Jesus, that's what they see, because that's what they're bringing to it. So joy is great, and I don't think Christian joy is any better or any more special than the joy that many of the rest of us have in this life. And if that were the measure, then we come out even. It just comes out flat, doesn't it?
Carolyn, how would you respond to that? That sense which Dan says that joy is not the measure, truth is. Because for you, truth was really important, actually.
Truth
wasn't
the measure for me. I actually didn't feel joy reading the Bible. And I didn't say that I was moved by Christian's joy. That's not actually, I was moved by or intrigued by something they had or some way that they lived that was different. So it was most actually, I would have to say agape or love. And what I mean by that is not the empty bumper sticker kind of love that, you know, we just throw around the empty word, but, and not the fair weather love where I love you when I'm in the mood, but a commandment to love. And that's why I eventually became a follower of Christ, who is and a follower of the New Testament in a sense, which of course builds on the old, but is an atonement and redemption of the old. So there's that commandment to love and to love others as I love myself was actually really what spoke to me the most. And not that we do that perfectly. It was joy that was a reminder. It was the fleeting sense of joy, something that I couldn't quite grasp that made me realize or feel or recognize. He gave, Lewis, for example, gave me a language for that longing. But that was not the compulsion of the Bible, nor of Christians, the primary one at all. That was an internal gauge of a remembrance of something that I had not yet experienced, but had a sense that it was there or towards which I was moving, or that was compelling in the sense of being reminded rather than instructed. But love is where the line is in the sand.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. And I guess Lewis as well, you know, for him, truth was a really important part of it, particularly if, it, you know, in some ways the account of him kneeling on the floor, the most reluctant and dejected convert in all England is that he's sort of believing despite wanting to. He's, you know, it's truth as a like over and above what he wants to be true. It's sort of true despite his longing for it. And he says this in Mere Christianity: my faith is based on reason. The battle is between my faith and reason on one side and my emotion and imagination on the other. Dan, I'd love to know what you think of that, that he believes that his faith is based on reason. And I get the sense that you might perhaps pit faith and reason against each other in a way that C.S. Lewis doesn't. He thinks that the two go together, that his faith is actually informed by his rational decisions.
Well, I used to preach that my faith was based on reason, but it's not. Faith is not reasonable. You can have faith in anything you want as long as you admit it. But if you use words like truth, what do you mean by that? What does the word truth even mean? And to me, and I think to many, many philosophers and others, truth is simply the degree with which a statement corresponds with reality. And you can't just pick and choose some reality and then say, that's my truth, because that's what some ancient Israelite prophet said, or some you know, early Christian thinker said, that's my truth. How do you know that it's true? How would C.S. Lewis even know that what words of the Bible say are true unless he is already predisposed to the acceptance of a transcendental world, as you will. And I know in Mere Christianity, he tries to make a case based on what he calls the moral law, that there is some kind of a back world behind all of us. And I admire him for trying to do that. He does it very well, but he's wrong. He's got things totally upside down. So, if you pick a framework of truth, and then you use that as your measure, you can say anything's reasonable. It's reasonable according to this measure that I picked. When I was reading the Bhagavad Gita and I was reading about Arjuna and Krishna and all of those stories in there, you could see that author was convinced of the truth of Shiva and Krishna, and the beautiful literature, by the way, amazing writing. The story of the battle that's there in the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, philosophically and you know, epistemologically, it's ludicrous. The whole story is ludicrous. Just like the Old Testament stories are ludicrous. They didn't happen. They were stories that the writers believed happened. But in a literary sense, they're quite moving. They're telling us something about human nature at the time, the way people believed. So Lewis was making a good stab at trying to connect reason with what he thought was the truth, but he was wrong.
Carolyn, do you have any thoughts on that? And I guess, do you have any thoughts on some of his arguments in Mere Christianity that Dan's alluded to there?
Well, I think that idea of a moral or natural law, right, is in a sense that there is some universal sense in which we are attracted to what seems wrong. I mean, which would be at the roots of something like rights or judgment or deciding what is good or bad, you know, whether to murder or not, whether to have any kind of rights in our society or not, do have those Judean Christian roots. And that there seems to be, I don't think faith and reason are antithetical at all. And that really, in a sense, everything is taken by faith. And we're at a point in our culture today where we can say anything we would want and declare that a truth, whether as ridiculous or, you know, as unsupported as it might be in every single way. So that's never solved anything. All those wars just shift and change, but they remain the same. But I thought, you know, when you were talking about myths and things, Dan, you know, I think that's what Lewis was drawing on, is that myths are stories, but they're stories in a sense that are true. They point to truths within ourselves. They point to things that we know from being within our human identities, being within our human experiences. And so, sure, you know, are they literal? Is there wiggle room in there? Are we going to hair split on what all the different stories and symbols mean? Is that really our cross to die on? I'm not sure. But when we, you know, read the story of something like Adam and Eve and we look at the notion of sin, that makes great sense, I think, to how we operate. When we look at how, you know, we can make draw on having rights to any rights at all seems to suggest that we crave and desire and demand dignity. Where does that concept come from? If it only comes relatively from within you and I, depend on how we feel, reason, you know, although it's the viceroy in me and I should defend, is not everything. I don't think faith is not math. And it doesn't mean that it can't include that. But I think reason is actually quite limited, by things that we can't control, by, you know, it's as limited as your cough, you know, if you are, feeling well or whatnot, right. You know, then it'll function, but there's also things in which, we have to have faith and reason too.
Dan, I'd love to hear your response to Carolyn, but also just to throw in another C.S. Lewis quote, which is quite a famous quote that's often quoted from Mere Christianity, that my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust, but how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. And I suppose that's kind of what Carolyn was saying there, that actually, you know, where do we even get this kind of reference point for right or wrong if it's not just within ourselves? And Lewis is obviously drawing on something outside of himself and saying that's our benchmark, and that's how we know that a straight line is a straight line, a crooked line is a crooked line. What are your thoughts on that, Dan?
Yeah, well, Lewis was really brilliant at drawing those analogies, and I admire that. I think he had a great talent for writing, for making complex issues clear. I think he was wrong. You know, I think the writer of the Bhagavad Gita was talented, you know, and I think many parts of the Quran are talented. A lot of it is nonsensical, but so morality, you know, Lewis in Mere Christianity makes this argument that there is a moral law or a natural law, or what did you call it, the human law, that seems to transcend because we all have references. We know that's right and that's wrong. But you don't need that to have a good moral system. You don't need that at all. And in fact, many people function in life without thinking that there needs to be something behind it all. When you think about how we evolved, the instincts we have, and he wrote about instincts, and I think he wrote correctly that instincts can be good or bad, depending on how they're used, and there's no one right one or not. Many of the instincts that we have turn out to be useful in the environment in which we evolve, but sometimes the environment has changed and those same instincts are no longer good anymore. I remember when I was in the Detroit airport, this was like in the late 80s, I was flying to be on the Phil Donahue show, changing planes in Detroit. And in the line going to another gate, this was before 9/11, there was a young couple that they had this little baby carrier up on top of the luggage on top of this cart, about, you know, this high off the ground. And I wasn't paying any attention, but the corner of my eye, the father must have walked away. The corner of my eye saw that baby thing start to roll off the luggage to fall down to the hard floor. And I saw myself with no thought, with no moral deliberation, with no thinking about how can I show the world that I'm a good Christian or what's the right thing to do. I saw myself stretching my arm across, grabbing that thing and catching it just in time to keep it from falling totally off. And then the mother grabbed it about a second later. She would have been too late. And we were both holding on to this thing. My heart was kind of pounding, and that was scary. It was like, whoa, you know. That was instinct. That was not judgment. That was not planned. That was not calculated. And I think it's because our ancestors, who were less likely to keep babies from falling, were less likely to pass that genetic information down to us. That's a pretty basic scientific idea, right? So many of our moral actions are instinctive, and we should be glad for that. Sometimes instinct is wrong, but you don't need something behind it all. If morality, and I don't know if Lewis actually gave a formal definition of morality itself. The Bible never does. The Bible doesn't even have the word moral or morality. The Bible just reduces to obeying God. But if morality means, and this is what I think it means, acting in such a way that you're trying to minimize harm in the real world. If that's what we mean by morality, and I think it is, we want a world with less harm, you know, with more freedom and less threats, less danger. If that's what morality means, that I'm acting in such a way, well, that instinct was going towards that, right? But if you have the time to think about it, you can use reason, and you should use reason. We don't always have the time, which is why sometimes quick instincts are good. So what reason would say is you should base your actions on the consequences that either cause more or less actual harm in the real world. That's what we mean by morality, in which case moral values are not objective things. They're not some big law out there or around us. Moral values are values and judgments in a human brain that can be objectively justified by reference to reality. And that's what truth means. A statement has a reference to reality. So we can make moral judgments. We can't always make the right decision because we don't always have enough information, right? If we had more information, we would act better. But at least if your intention is to act with the idea of minimizing real harm in the real world, you're a moral person, and that's good for society. It's good for the tribe. It's good for the individual. It's good for the family. It's good for all of us without some spooky reference to something behind all of that. So I think Lewis failed to see that there can be very useful, plausible, naturalistic moral philosophies that don't require us to transcend the natural universe.
We are going to need to go to a quick break, but Carolyn, do you just have a quick response to that? I could sort of see you itching to say something in response.
No, of course. I think that you use analogy very well for your argument and and an illustration. But and that's, I do think when we can act quickly, sometimes, of course, instinct, that might be an argument as well, that that's been wired in us by a designer to help us survive. But when we do have time to think, or we're trying to weigh what harm is, is our reason sufficient? if you reached to grab that child falling from a high space, would you also reach to save the child that has not yet been born? And how do we weigh those kind of decisions and those kind of moral implications? And how do we measure harm? To whom and to what across what measures? Those are the kind of questions that are not instinctual.
Can I reply quickly?
Of course you can. Go for it.
Whatever harm is, it is natural. And you can think of 1,000 different things that harm are. Disease or threats or natural disasters or oppression or rape or whatever, violence. Whatever it is, it's natural. And being natural, then it can be measured. It can have a metric. You can see what harm would be more or what would be less. You can use reason at least to make a good attempt at determining the consequences of your action. You can do that. You can't always be perfect, but that's much better than following the commands of some deity in a holy book.
I don't think we can see the repercussions of our harm, and that's a large compulsion behind something like the Christian worldview is why we have repentance and why we have obedience, and sometimes in things that we cannot see because we can't see the repercussions of them or the depths of those repercussions in our limited view at the moment.
This is fascinating stuff, and I really don't want to stop, but we do have to take a quick break. But we'll be hearing more from Dan Barker and Carolyn Webber very shortly. We'd also love to know what you think. Drop us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. That was the second part of a discussion that I had with atheist Dan Barker and Christian Dr. Carolyn Webber on Premier Unbelievable, looking at whether C.S. Lewis is still relevant today. You can hear the third part next week. Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @PremierUnbelievableFE, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @PremierUnbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @Premier.Unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.